We're holding on page Tess in Bavakama, the paragraph labeled, in the middle of the paragraph labeled, Daf Ein Tess on the Bays, and near the end of Oiskof Bays. We left off yesterday talking about the difference between a Ganav and a Gazlan. A Ganav, the Torah tells us, has to pay double or four or five times, depending on the circumstances. A Gazlan only pays Keren, so we need to know which is which. So we talked about, suppose a person is hiding out in the forest and taking animals that belong to people that are grazing there in the forest. Or a different explanation, that was according to Rashi and Tosfos, according to the Rambam, it would mean that he hid an animal in the forest. So we said that if people see him, isn't he a gazlan? And the answer is no, because he's hiding out from them, so therefore he's a ganav. The definition of a ganav, as we're going to say soon, is where he's afraid of people's reaction, and therefore he hides out. So we were saying, we left off kind of in the middle of a sentence there, ve'el a gazlan hechidami, so what is the definition of a gazlan? Amar Rabba Bohukhan ben Yohu ben Yehoyada. You have the example where the Pasuk says about ben Yohu ben Yehoyada, one of David's mighty men, Shenema, the Pasuk says, the Pasuk tells us, at one point he was in single combat against a tall Mitzri guy, five amas tall, the Pasuk says. You're talking, according to Rabbi Avraham Chaim Noah, an amma is a foot and a half, so the guy would have been 7.5 feet tall. According to the Chazon Ish, an amma is 2 feet, so the guy would have been closer to 10 feet tall. In any case, Benayahu was fighting against him, and the guy had a spear. And a mitzvah, the pasuk says that Benayahu grabbed the spear away from the mitzvah and killed him with his own spear. So we see that the word gezel means to actually literally grab something openly from somebody else. So the Gemara continues. Rabbi Yochanan Omer. Rabbi Yochanan says here's another pasuk that shows us what the definition of a gazlan is. You have, for example, the people of Shechem. In Sefer Shoftim, you have the story how you have the Shofet Gideon. After he passed away, he had a son named Abimelech, his mother was from Shechem, so he went and convinced the people of Shechem to accept him as king, and he ended up being not a very nice guy. He killed all his brothers, etc., etc. Anyway, to make a long story short, eventually he had a falling out with the people of Shechem, and now they're fighting one against the other. So the pasuk describes how at one point the people of Shechem were going some of the tough guys from Shechem were going and then setting ambushes in the mountains and going and stealing from passersby, like in order to foment a revolt. So the pasuk says Shenema by Yasimu Lo Bal Shechem Ma'orvim Al Rosh Ha'Harim, the people of Shechem set up people who were hiding out, people ambushes on the tops of the mountains, and they were robbing from everybody who passed by them on the road. With the point being that this way they would peel off Avimelech's supporters, they would rob them, and this way Avimelech would eventually be isolated. So the point is, again, it uses the word vayigzalu, implying that they're highway robbers. So therefore that's another pasuk that tells us the definition of gezel. So the question is, Rabbi Boho, my time on the Amar Mehai. That Shriftim is before Shmuel. Why doesn't Rabbi Boho use that pasuk rather than the pasuk about Bnei Yohu ben Yehoyada to define what a gazlan is? And the answer is Amalach, because Rabbi Boho will answer you. The fact is, they're hiding out over there. They're lying in ambush. So they're hiding out. Lav gazlonin inu. Then by definition, they're not gazlonin, because a gazlon would have to be somebody, like we just said, with Benayahu, where he's openly confronting the guy and where he's openly confronting his victim and robbing him. So therefore, the Baal Shechem would actually have been ganavim, and if anybody was going to take him to Beis Din, then they would in fact be chayav to pay kefil. What does Rabbi Yochanan answer back to that? He says, "Hold what page test at the bottom? What are you asking?
Gazlan pays kefil.
No, a gazlan pays only keren. A ganav pays kefil. So what we're saying is, Rabbi Bohu is defining what these people of Shechem are doing, ambushing people on the road, is Rabbi Bohu considers them, Rabbi Yochanan rather, considers them gazlonim. If anybody had taken them to Beis Din, they would pay only keren. Rabbi Bohu defines them as ganovim because they're hiding out. So therefore, Rabbi Bohu says, even though the Pasuk does say Vayigzalu, nevertheless, that cannot be the definition of Gazlan. Rather, we have to use the Pasuk with Benayahu, where he's openly fighting against this Mitzri guy and grabbing his spear away from him.
Yeah.
So that was so these guys from Shechem would have been Ganovim, says Rabbahu, whereas Benayohu would be an example of a Gazlan. Yeah, we're going to talk about that in the next piece, just a second. So for Rabbi Yochanan, what is Rabbi Yochanan answer to that? He says, Hodukamitamri, you know why these people of Shechem are hiding out over there? Not because they're afraid of people, but just letting Hazinu Inshiv in the Erkaminahu, just because they don't want their would-be victims to see them and run away. But they're not hiding out because they're actually afraid of what people are going to what people's reactions are when they see them stealing. So therefore, they can still, Rabbi Yochanan would say, they can still be considered gazlanim. They're not afraid of Hashem. They're not afraid of people either. They're just hiding out as a tactical thing so that they can so they can jump on people unexpectedly. Okay. So now, yes, we have this distinction between ganav and gazlan. So let's talk about why is there that distinction in Torah. Shalu Talmidim, as Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Talmidim asked him, "B'nei Mahech Mira Torah beGanav Yosef miGazlan? Why is the Torah more machmir on a Ganav and makes him pay at least kefil and sometimes even above a chamisha more than a Gazlan who always pays only keren?" So why is the Ganav being treated more harshly? So Rabbi Yochanan answers, Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai answers them, Zeh Hishva Kvod Eved B'Kvod Toinai, because the Gazlan is equating the kavod of the servant, meaning of human beings, to the honor of his creator. In other words, he's not afraid of either person. He's not afraid of anybody. He's not afraid of people, because we're saying he's openly going and robbing them. Or even we say he hides out by the side of the road, as Rabbi Yochanan says, he's only doing that as a tactical thing in order to be able to jump on them unexpectedly. But he's not concerned about their reaction. He's not afraid of them. He's not afraid of Hashem either. The Zeh, as opposed to the Ganav, in a way, is more serious. He does not equate the covet of the servant to the covet of the master, of the creator. In other words, he says, "I'm afraid of people." He's afraid of people. Therefore, he goes and does it secretly, so nobody knows what he's doing. But he's not afraid of Hashem. He doesn't take into consideration that Hashem is always watching him. Therefore, in a way, he's worse. He's showing like a greater chutzpah against Hashem. So in other words, Maharsha teaches out that the Ganav, when you get down to it, what it means is, in other words, the Ganav, we're saying, is afraid of human punishment. Therefore, he's trying to do things in a way where he won't be caught because he's afraid that he's going to be caught and taken to Beis Din and punished. But he's not afraid of the judgment of Hashem. So it amounts to, therefore, that he's denying Hashem's Ashgacha Pratis and he's denying Hashem's Schar V'Onish. The Gazlan is not denying anything because we see he's not afraid of punishment down here either. So it's just he thinks to himself he has more to gain from his robbery than he has to lose. In other words, basically a Gazlan is willing to take his chances. The Ganav, we're saying, is not willing to take his chances. If he was, he wouldn't be doing it in stealth. He's just saying, I don't want to take my chances, I don't want to be punished, but which punishment is he concerned about? Only Boss of Adam, he's not concerned about, he doesn't think about the punishment of Hashem. So in that sense, he's worse. Now, there is the fact, on the other hand, the Gemara does mention in other places, that the fact is, in a way, though, when a person does an Aveda, we've learned this before, when a person does an Aveda in public is, in a way, worse sometimes because it creates a Chilul Hashem. So there is that factor as well, but here we're not factoring that in. Over here, we're saying that he's pretending as though Hashem is not watching, whereas the Gazlan is clearly not afraid of anybody. That's something else, right? You have the Gemara and Grin Brachas. So he would be the Ganav, Ganvapun Machtauta, where he's about to tunnel into a house. He's a Ganav, he's hiding out, he's trying to do it in stealth, and he davens to Hashem, right? You have the famous thing in Chassidus that's where his Amunah is Bechinas Makif. He only believes in Hashem like in a superficial, encompassing kind of way. He recognizes that he depends on Hashem, but it doesn't make him think that then he shouldn't be stealing, right? Right, but here we're saying that in addition, he's b'chalal denying Hashem's judgment in the first place. There are other explanations that Mephoshim talk about of other reasons of the distinction. One of them is a Gazlan usually is just kind of doing on the spur of the moment. A Ganav is he plans in advance. He makes all the plans to hide out and to do it in a way that he won't be caught, etc. And that kind of thing is in a way more serious. There's a story along those lines involving the Alter Rebbe and the and Rebbe Yitzchak Berditchever, that one time a chassid, I don't remember actually, the chassid went to one of them first and then he sent him to the other. I don't remember where. I think he first went to the Alter Rebbe and then, anyway, whatever. He went to one of these two and told him about an aveira that he had done, something involving znus with a lady, where in order to make sure it wouldn't be a matter of nida, he made sure that he waited until after she had gone to the mikveh. And the Rebbe, whichever Rebbe it is, tells him, Zibinteg Gvarta van Aveira. So you're telling me you planned so far in advance that you're planning for 7 days till you can do this Aveira, I can't help you. And he sends him off to the other one. And the other one is able to be a shtickle malamed z'chus on him and help him to do tshuva. So there's this idea, like a premeditated aveira is kind of a worse thing in a way, and that's what the ganav is doing. And there's a number of other points along those lines of the difference between the ganav and the gazlan. So the Gemara, so sort of Yechim and Zake goes on, Kivyochol osa ayin shomata kilo eneroya. Kivyochol, it's like he's making the eye down here. Now really it means the eye up there. It means Hashem's eye, but the Gemara doesn't want to speak disrespectfully about Hashem. So he uses this euphemism instead, ayin shomata kilo eneroya, as though it doesn't see. For oizen shomata kilo eneshamas, and the ear below, really meaning above by Hashem, as if it doesn't hear. So he pretends as though Hashem is not watching and hearing everything that he does. So therefore, that's the ganav, as opposed to, again, the gazlan was saying, is Bechlal just not afraid of anybody, he's samachutz banyak, so therefore, in a way, he's not as bad as the ganav. Shenema, as the pasuk says, Hoy ha-ma'amikim be'Hashem laster etzah, woe to those who try to make their ideas deep against Hashem, to hide their plans, so they're trying to do it, they're trying to tunnel deep down and hide what they're doing, and thinking that they can get away with it, that Hashem's not going to notice. And they do those things in darkness, and they think that Hashem is not watching. Another pasuk says, people say, the Rishoyim say Hashem is not watching, and the God of Yaakov does not understand. And you have another pasuk expressing this corrupt idea of there is ki omru, such people say, Ozav Hashem es ha'aretz, Hashem has abandoned the world, ve'ein Hashem roya, and Hashem is not watching. So this is the mentality that they have, that Hashem doesn't care, and Hashem is not looking, and Hashem is not watching, and therefore we can get away with it. So therefore, so the ganav, therefore, is treated more harshly, and he's made to pay double or four or five times as much. There's a sicha in Chelek Tazayin, primarily it's a sicha shelling Zichana Rashi in Parshas Mishpatim, where it talks about the 4 and 5, which we're going to have the next thing over here in the Gemara about the difference why 4 for a sheep and 5 for an ox. But in the course of it, it's a long sicha, and the Rebbe also addresses this Gemara and explains why does Rabbi Yechim and Zakeh need 3 psukim to tell us the same idea. He says because it's a progression. It ends off with that the person thinks that he can do in darkness and Hashem won't see, because he thinks, the same way as a boss of a dumb doesn't see in darkness, the same way Hashem doesn't either. What leads him to that mistake is the second pasuk, that he thinks, La Yura Kavah, La Yavan Ala Keyakim. Now he knows, as it says in the pasuk over there, Anota Ozen Hala Yishma, Hashem who implanted the ear and the eye into a person, does he not hear and does he not see himself? But this person thinks, you know what? Hashem's sight, though, must be similar to ours. We need physical eyes to see. Therefore, Hashem must need physical eyes to see as well. And therefore, he figures physical eyes don't work in the dark, and therefore Hashem's don't either. And that, in turn, is caused because he starts with the with the initial mistake of thinking, Ozav Hashem es ha'aretz, that Hashem is way up there in Shemayim and not directly involved in what's going down here on earth. So therefore, one says, therefore, so the mistake of the third pasuk leads to the mistake of the second, which in turn leads to the mistake of the first, which now makes him think that he can hide out in the dark and do whatever he wants, and Hashem's not watching. The Gemara continues, Tanya Omer Rav Meir, Moshlu Moshul Mishum Rav Gamliel. They said in the name of Rav Gamliel, a Moshul, further to illustrate this point about the difference between the Ganav and the Gazlan in terms of the Chutzpah against Hashem. Again, like we're saying, that the Gazlan is not afraid of Boss of Adam or of Hashem, whereas the Ganav is afraid of Boss of Adam, but not Hashem. Here's a Moshul that illustrates this point, says Rav Meir. What is this like? Two people who live in a town, but also mishka, and both of them make a party. One of them invited all the people of the city, but he did not invite the king's sons. The other one didn't invite anybody, not the townspeople and not the king's sons. Which one deserves a harsher punishment? Must be the one who invited the other people, the commoners, but he didn't invite the princes, the sons of the king. Maybe he doesn't want to invite anybody. Okay, so it means, you know, he's a misanthropic kind of guy. He doesn't like to invite people to his parties. But if he's inviting and showing covered to everybody else, is not showing covered to the king's sons, therefore he gets a harsher punishment. What do the king's sons represent in this connection? The Riaf over here on Ein Yaakov points out you can have a case, there can be a situation where a ganav ends up having to bring a korban oshem, as opposed to a gazlan. So you have a case where he swears falsely. They eventually catch him, and he swears falsely that he didn't steal, and later on he's murdered, so then he has to pay an oshem. So now the Bnei HaMelech over here represents the Koyanim. If he's bringing an Oshem, then the meat of it is going to be eaten by the Koyanim. As opposed to the Gazlan is not going to be in that situation. He's not going to end up bringing an Oshem. So in that sense, then the Ganav, in a way, as long as he does end up having to pay kefil or abal chamisha, which then he's not bringing the osham because the osham is only when he admits, then in that sense, and then in terms of the mushal, therefore he's inviting the other people, but he's leaving out the sons of the king, namely the koyanim, and not giving them the osham that he should have admitted to the crime and brought an osham for his kapara. The Rebbe in that Sicha in Chelek Tezayin also discusses this further. The point that in that Rashi in Parshas Mishpatim, it brings the Gemara is next going to bring from Reb Meir and from Reb Yechon ben Zakkai two different reasons why you have the difference between four for a sheep and five for an ox, and the Rebbe develops the idea over there. And Reb Yechon ben Zakkai is focusing more on kavod abrius, and Reb Meir is focusing more on lack of kavod to Hashem. So therefore, said Rabbi Yechon ben Zakkai, So in particular, Rabbi Meir mentions the point, from the point of view of the ganav, what he did wrong versus what he did to the nignav, to the victim from whom he stole. So Rabbi Yechon ben Zakkai and Rabbi Meir are taking different views of that, but that's also why Rabbi Meir is using the metaphor of that he invites everybody else, but not the Bnei HaMelech, representing, in other words, like he's not looking out for the covert of other people. He's violating the covert of other people with his stealing, whereas Rabbi Yechon ben Zakkai is focusing more on the insults to Hashem. He, as the ganav, is violating what Hashem wants. Or maybe I may have that backwards, actually, now that I think of it, because the Rebbe also points out that we find Rabbi Yechon ben Zakkai was very concerned with covert abrius. We find that the Gemara says that Rabbi Yechon ben Zakkai would always be sure to greet everybody first in the street. He would never have that somebody else greets him and he replies. So we see that Rabbi Yechon ben Zakkai is extremely concerned for kavod abrius, whereas Rabbi Meir, we don't specifically find that by Rabbi Meir. We find something else by Rabbi Meir that we'll talk about in a minute. The Rebbe ends up saying at the end of the Sicha, Rabbi Meir uses the metaphor of a mishnah, because after all, what's the ultimately what we want out of all of this is even a person did a serious aveda like that and stole and pretended that Hashem is not watching and so on and so forth. Eventually, he should do tshuva, and that's the real mishnah that we get out of it after all. So the Gemara continues, Amar Reb Meir, Boyerei Kama Gadol, let's talk about the difference between the four and the five. Amar Reb Meir, Boyerei Kama Gadol Koicha Shamalacha. Come see how great is the power of doing work. Shosh Bitla Mimalachta, a person steals an ox from somebody else, and then he shechts it or sells it, where now he's making that it will never be, that the original owner will never do work with it again. Kamisha, therefore the Torah makes him pay five times as much. With a sheep where he didn't, because sheep don't do work, Dalid, then he gets away with paying only four times as much. So he gets a break kind of because he wasn't mevatel the animal from Malacha. Marsha points out, you know, I mean, so what? And what if he stole a baby calf that doesn't do Malacha either? Fine, but eventually it'll grow up and it'll be an animal capable of doing Malacha. By a sheep we make him only pay four times as much as opposed to by an ox five. Yeah. The Riach points out over here, I mean, okay, if he only stole the animal, at least the original owner is going to get it back sooner or later. But if he shechts it or sells it, we're there. If he shechts it, obviously the original owner is not getting it back alive. And if he sold it, then as the Gemara had discussed earlier in the Perek, you have this whole concept of shinu reshus, where therefore he's also not obligated to return the original animal, just the value of it. So therefore now he really was permanently mevatel from Malacha. And therefore the Torah is being more stringent on him and making him pay an extra time as much.
The rabbi, the guy that takes the sheep, took someone on his shoulder.
That's the next thing. Hold on. That's the next thing.
Okay, good.
You were talking about the mayor's opinion. I'm going to be... What? So why 4 and 5 is because... You have 2 to begin with, just for the fact that he stole. He's always paying kafel, and then on top of that, we're penalizing him the extra amount if it was a sheep, and even more than that if it was an ox. So therefore, it comes out to 4 or 5 respectively. That's what we're saying, because in other words, we're saying that the minimum he should have to pay is at least twice what he did originally. Because like we learned yesterday, he's gotten embedded in the Aveda, he's compounded the Aveda. So therefore, at least he should be paying twice what he would have otherwise. He would have paid kafel if it hadn't been for this. Now he's paying 4 times as much. Now, if it's an ox, and as the mayor said, now in addition, he's causing that the owner of the ox can't do work with it anymore. Therefore, we put an extra 1 on top of that, and it comes out 5. Rabbi Yechim and Zakeh looks at it a different way. Come and see how great is the concern for the honor of people. An ox, when he steals it, the animal walks on its feet. Or Marshall says, okay, even if it's a baby animal, it won't necessarily, but at least it's of the species that usually will. So therefore, Chamisha, therefore we make him pay 5. Seshel, but the sheep, he carries it on his shoulder, and therefore he suffers a loss of dignity with that. Therefore, Abba, so therefore Hashem, so to speak, gives him a break and reduces his penalty by 1 and brings him down to 4. So here in that Sikha, in Chelek Tazayin, again, the Rebbe says, this is why in that Rashi, usually Rashi doesn't bring the names of the Chachamim who have the respective opinions, unless there's a reason to, unless it shows us that they're going L'shitas them. So here the Rebbe explained, now that we explained before, based on what Rabbi Yechon and Zakkai and Rabbi Meir are saying respectively in the Gemara over here, that Rabbi Yechon and Zakkai is concerned about Kvod Abrius, and Rabbi Meir doesn't factor that in as much, then therefore that explains why Rabbi Yechon and Zakkai is focusing on Kvod Abrius. By rights, he should have had, in other words, the Rebbe explains, from the point of view of that he was a ganav, he should have to pay 4. From the point of view of the nignav, the person that he victimized, he should have to pay 5. So there's not really an argument between Rabbi Yechon and Zakkai and Rabbi Meir. Each one is just focusing on a different side of it. So Rabbi Yechon and Zakkai is focusing on the kvod abrius angle of it, and Rabbi Meir is focusing on the other angle. The Rebbe explains, Ion Yaakov also mentions over here briefly, that, now you think about it, we're talking about this ox would have been used for malacha. But if it was going to be used for malacha, what's the likelihood that the thief would shecht it then? Why would he shecht it? He could himself use it for plowing a field or something.
Mm-hmm.
The answer is, and the answer, so why are we saying bitloim the malacha if he ends up shechting it? And the answer is because you do have a miut, it's true, in general, an animal that's capable of doing plowing, you're not going to shecht. But there is a miut, there is a minority of animals where even though you're capable of using them for malacha, you would still go shecht them. And Reb Meir, as we know in various places in Shas, is chayish l'miyuta, he's concerned about the miut, therefore he has reason to mention the point about bitloim the malacha. It's not common. Usually when you shecht the animal, it will mean that it was not in fact suited for malacha. But Reb Meir, being that he holds chayish l'miyuta, then he takes that into consideration.
Right, if it's not suited for malacha, it's shechted.
Right, but the point is, no, but Reb Meir is saying, bitloim malacha, implying that this animal was capable of malacha. So in other words,
isn't another reason why they'd want to shecht it instead of using for...
There could be a wild animal or something, but in general...
Okay.
Most of the time, if the animal is capable of plowing, you're going to do that rather than shechting.
Okay.
So as I said, it's a long sikha, and the Rebbe deals with various angles on the Rashi and on this Gemara over here, but this is kind of a summary of some of the points from that sikha. So one interesting point in this regard, you know, we're talking about Kvod Abrius. I mean, the guy himself is causing himself a loss of dignity. Nobody told him to steal the animal in the first place and put it on his shoulder. Nevertheless, the fact is there is a certain loss of dignity over there, and therefore Hashem factors that in when reducing his punishment.
He causes the whole thing on himself.
He causes the whole thing on himself, but nevertheless, yeah. most of the perek, again, has talked about this din of what happens if a person steals an animal and shechts it or sells it. So now, the end of the perek talks about the dinim of raising animals in Eretz Yisrael. So the mission...
The thing is, if the guy did something with the sheep, or he stole the sheep, or why is he carrying it on his shoulder?
Because he's stealing it. The way to steal it, a baby sheep, is not going to be able to walk by itself, so he carries it.
So now you're mixing up dignity. Why are you reducing the punishment?
No, but that's what the mayor is. That's what Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai is saying. Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai. Right. Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai, whose key thing is Kavod Abrius. That's the point. Let me try to explain. So since the point is, even though, yes, the lack of dignity was he caused himself by carrying an animal on his shoulder, obviously nobody told him to steal and put it on his shoulder in the first place, but once he did, Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai considers Kavod Abrius such an important factor, as we see, L'shitasei, that again, he focuses before on the point about putting the covered of people on an equal level or a higher level than Hashem, and the fact that he would always greet people in the street rather than wait for people to greet him first. So he's extremely concerned about Kavod Abrius, and therefore he holds, even in this case, even though he brought it on himself, nevertheless, that lack of covered for him, the fact that he has to walk around, the fact that he's walking around carrying a sheep on his shoulders, because that would be the way to get the animal to go, is enough to reduce his punishment by one.
Yeah, but that's like saying, before someone murders somebody, he says, excuse me, so he'll get rewarded for the excuse me.
Nobody's rewarding anybody. We're not rewarding anybody, but we're saying that his punishment
and
is...
You're mixing up...
Okay, we're mitigating his punishment a little bit because of the cover evidence. That's,
okay.
Okay. The Mishnah says... We're not allowed to raise small animals, sheep and goats, in Eretz Yisrael because they go and graze in other people's fields. Primarily, this applies, by the way, when most of the fields in Eretz Yisrael were owned by Jews. Eventually, as time went on and Eretz Yisrael was mostly taken over by the Goyim, then this din went away. It's a machlokas haposkim of our times, whether it applies nowadays when many parts of Eretz Yisrael are back in Jewish hands, Baruch Hashem. Does the din still apply or not? Rabbi Avadi Yosef says it does. Rabbi Tzvi Pesach Frank says it doesn't.
What's the reason for this?
The reason is because usually small animals like that graze in other people's fields. So therefore, it's going to damage other people's fields. It's causing a hazard. So you're not allowed to raise behemoth daka, small animals, sheep and goats, in Eretz Yisrael.
If all are yidden, I mean, what's the difference? I mean,
what?
You said because all are yidden right now in Eretz Yisrael.
Originally, most of Eretz Yisrael was in the hands of Jews. So therefore, if it's going to graze in a field, chances are it's going to be a Jewish field.
So,
over time, over hundreds of years of Golos, when there were very few Jews in Eretz Yisrael, and most of the fields were in the hands of the Goyim, then that din didn't apply. Does it apply nowadays? That's what I'm saying. You have a machlokas between the poskim achronim, whether it goes back into effect now.
Okay.
One way of looking at it is, sure, the tam existed of Rabbi Yosef takes the view. Yeah, the tam exists again, because many of the fields are owned by Jews, therefore the din should go back into effect. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, the Rav of Yerushalayim a few decades ago, on the other hand, takes the view that no, first of all, once a gzera is bottle, then we don't reestablish it again in general. Second of all, we can actually argue that nowadays, when Jews are going and buying fields and lands in Eretz Yisrael, in effect, it's like they were agreeing. It's like there was an unwritten part of the rule that they were going to allow other people to raise sheep and goats there and not protest about it. Mm-hmm. So therefore, like they're moichel on their rights. Okay. But you are allowed to raise small animals in Syria. Syria is the areas near Eretz Yisrael that David conquered. As the Gemara says here, Rashi explains that based on various other Gemaras, that David conquered it before he had conquered all of Eretz Yisrael proper. So therefore, it's called Kibush Yochid. It's called an individual's conquest. Now, the original Eretz Yisrael, they didn't manage to conquer all of Eretz Yisrael in Yeshua's times. The Pesukim in Yeshua mentioned there were areas that were left unconquered, but they officially divided it up among the Shvatim, so that later on, after Yeshua passes away and the different Shvatim go and continue conquering their areas, it'll be considered Kibush Rabim. Now, the din is, a Jewish king, with the permission of the Sanhedrin and the Urim V'Tumim and all that, can go and conquer areas that are outside Eretz Yisrael proper, and they will have the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, but he needs the consent of the Sanhedrin. Here, David went and conquered Aram Tzoiva and various other areas in Syria and in Syria and in surrounding countries without the consent of the Sanhedrin, because he hadn't even conquered all of Eretz Yisrael proper yet. They told him, Samuch Lepalton Shalchola Kavashta. You haven't even conquered those areas of Yerushalayim that are still in Goyish hands. What are you doing in foreign adventures and conquering lands? So the result is, those lands, therefore, have their, they're like half, they're like semi-Eretz Yisrael, but not completely. In some ways, those areas have the din of Eretz Yisrael, in some ways not. So our Mishnah holds that they don't have the din of Eretz Yisrael. They're considered like chutzlaretz. Now, as far as chutzlaretz, you're allowed to raise sheep and goats there. We're not worried about that they may damage other people's fields. If it happens to damage, fine, you'll pay. But you don't proactively, the Chacham are not going to proactively prevent you from raising small animals outside Eretz Yisrael. And so Syria is in the same category as well.
Did David HaMelech come to the conclusion that the Sanhedrin wouldn't be with him if he's going to conquer Syria because he didn't conquer the rest of Eretz Israel like Yerushalayim?
So I don't know whether he asked them and they said no and he went anyway, or maybe he asked them after that.
The king, I mean, he could tell us, look, I'm going to conquer Syria.
It doesn't work that way. A Jewish king has to follow the Torah.
But I follow the Torah, I go to Sanhedrin. But I mean, he's still king, you know?
Okay, nevertheless, yeah. All right. In order to do a Mechamas Rishus like that, he needs the consent of the Sanhedrin. Okay. Anyway, over Midboris Sheva Eretz Yisrael, also you can raise these small animals in their wildernesses in Eretz Yisrael. Midbo doesn't mean like the Sahara Desert or something. It just means like the areas that are not cultivated, the empty areas with lots of grasslands and things like that. So again, the idea is there's nobody's fields over there to damage. Continues the Mishnah, Ein Megadlin Tarni Golem B'Yerushalayim, you're not allowed to raise chickens in Yerushalayim, Mipnei HaKodshim, because of Kodshim. You have in Yerushalayim, people are always eating things that have to be, they're eating parts of Korbanos that have to be kept tahor. The problem is chickens peck around in the garbage a lot. So now you're going to have, they may find in the garbage, the chicken may peck at a piece of a dead sheretz over there and then take a piece of it in its beak and then move it around, and a piece, even a lentil-sized piece of a dead sheretz is enough to be metame, and therefore it's going to cause that people or foods are going to become tummy. So that you can't raise chickens in Yerushalayim when they're roaming around. The Forshim explained that if they're kept in a coop, then it's fine because then you don't have that issue. V'lekoyin and Be'eretz Yisrael, also, now this in Yerushalayim applies to everybody, even Yisraelim. But in addition, in the rest of Eretz Yisrael, it's not regular Yisraelim are allowed to raise chickens, but Koyanim cannot, if they have taras, because of things that have to be kept tahor. Koyanim all over Eretz Yisrael, eat truma, same issue, you're going to have the chickens are going to peck in the garbage and carry around pieces of a sheretz. The Mishnah continues, Ein Megadlin Chazirim B'chol Mokem.
Ein Forsim.
What? Oh, in the Gemara, you're not allowed to raise pigs anywhere. For reasons, the Gemara is going to tell us.
The Gemara to tell us that? Okay.
We need the Mishnah to tell us that. Mind you, Anaf Yosef actually points out that in general, you have a halacha, ein osulasa schorda v'dvorim tmeim. You're not allowed to make a business of selling trefa things. So that being the case, how would you, even before the Gemara is going to end up explaining that there was a gzera not to raise pigs because of maisa shahoya, we'll learn in the Gemara in the next few days, that's the shame. But anyway, you're not allowed to do schorda v'dvorim asurim. So he brings it, actually, to Anaf Yosef is quoting from Tosfos later on in the Perek. So Tosfos and Rabbeinu Tam explains, that's when you're raising things that are going to be eaten. But let's say, for example, a person could be raising pigs so that he wants to sell the skins or the fat of them or something.
Sell the coin.
Sell the skin, so you can sell the skins or the fat or whatever. Yeah. And as far as the meat, he'll use it to feed to animals or whatever. So that's not a problem of schorda b'dvarim asurim. But so it wouldn't be an isser if he wanted to do that with horses or camels or other kinds of non-kosher animals. But pigs, there's a specific isser on gzeira d'rabbanan, as we'll learn in a few days why that is. Okay. The Mishnah continues, Lo yigadalos hakelev, a person is not allowed to raise a dog, elein kein hayakosher b'shalshelas, unless the dog is tied up with a chain, because the dog is going to bark and frighten people, the Gemara is going to explain, in particular it can cause a pregnant woman to miscarry.
Good point.
Yeah. I once saw, you know, you have the famous secular Yiddishist writer, Shalom Aleichem. You know, even nowadays, it's somewhat uncommon for Jews to own dogs. 100 years ago in his time, yeah, it was even more so. So I read somewhere where he said the expression, if a Jew owns a dog, either the Jew is not much of a Jew or the dog is not much of a dog. Okay. So you're not allowed to raise a dog unless it's chained up. And another din, these are all ones we're mentioning about raising behemadaka, so the Mishnah is going on to mention different other rules about what kinds of animals you're allowed to raise. Ein person nishuvin layonim. Another din, you're not allowed to spread out nets or traps to catch pigeons, because the concern is that pigeons from the nearby town mm-hmm. are going to get caught in them and yep. going to end up catching other people's birds. Unless it is 30 ris away from the yishuv. The Gemara ends up explaining what a yishuv usually means town, but the Gemara ends up explaining that the word yishuv over here doesn't necessarily mean a town. It means an area that birds frequent. It means like a vineyard or different things like that where birds are often found. So if as long as it's 30 ris away from there, then that's fine, because any birds you're catching will be wild ones. What is a ris? So Rashi translates that 30 ris is 4 mil. A mil is 2,000 amas, so you're talking 8,000 amas. So a mil in modern terms is approximately a kilometer, about 3/5 to 4/5 of a mile, depending which posuk you ask. So 4 mil would be so 4 mil would be about 2.5 to 3 miles. So it has to be at least that far away from any yishuv.
Do you remember what Yermay has a question?
Yeah, that's something. Yeah, that's something else. we're saying that 30 ris comes out to 4 mil, which means therefore, so it means a ris is one part in 7.5 of a mil. Means, in other words, to say it the other way around, 7.5 ris make a mil. So a ris is equal mil being 2,000 amas divided by 7.5 comes out to 266 amas and change. It seems like a very odd figure. Tosfos actually mentions in one place, maybe the name of the measurement is not Ris with a Yud, but Rus with a Samach, which is actually Gematria. Rus, Reish Vav, with a Vav. Reish Vav Samach is Gematria 266. But where did they get such a measurement from? It seems like kind of an odd measurement. So years back, Yossel Keller gave me an interesting idea about this.
Yossel Keller?
Yeah, he used to live on my block.
Coral Springs.
Yeah, I know that. But he used to live on my block. But I know him from years back. Anyway, so he pointed out like this. What's the definition of an amma? Officially, it's the distance from your elbow to the tip of your middle finger. Again, according to Rabbi Avraham Chaim, no, it's approximately 1.5 feet. According to the Chazon Ish, it's larger than that. Now, you think about it. You also have the human foot. If you were to measure your foot against your arm like that, you would find your foot is approximately 2/3 the length of that distance of an amma. So if we suppose that they had a similar, a foot-like measurement in those times, it wasn't necessarily equal to an American foot of 12 inches, let's say it might have been a little longer or a little shorter, but whatever. If you work like that, then you could say an amma would be 2,000, I mean a mil would be 2,000 ammas, it would be 3,000, it would come out to 3,000 of those. And now if you divide that by 7.5, you come out to 400 of those foot-like measurements, and that's a nice round number. So they may have had, a ris would have been then, a measurement equal to 400 feet, which comes out, therefore, to 266 and change arms.
Isn't the correct measurement 50?
50 what? No, that's something else. That's the Gemara talks about. If the bird can't fly, if it can only walk, it won't walk more than 50 amas. But here again, here we're saying that as long as you have your traps more than 30 ris away from the yishuv, or away from the area where people's birds are likely to be located, where there are birdhouses or vineyards or whatever for them to hang out in, then you're fine, because then any birds you're trapping are more likely to be wild ones. So the Gemara tells in this connection that we're saying you're not allowed to raise the Hemadaka in Eretz Yisrael. Tana Rabbanan, Maisa b'chosid echad shei geneach milibay. It happened with a certain chosid who was groaning from pain in his heart. Chosid echad, the Gemara mentions elsewhere, is either Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava or Rabbi Yehuda ben Biloy. Geneach milibay, he was having some kind of chest pain or some kind of heart pain that was causing him to groan in pain. One possibility is it may have been something that's called nowadays in medicalese angina, which is basically where a person has a partial blockage of the arteries to the heart, so the heart is not getting enough blood, and therefore the muscles spasm and whatever, and a person has tremendous pain from it.
It's called arterial atherosclerosis.
That's something else. Atherosclerosis, something else. But yeah, anyway, the point is the shalu l'roifim, they ask the doctors what to do for him. And they said, "Emay takana, there's no cure for him. Ad sheyinak cholav reseach mishachris l'shachris. He has to suckle hot milk, fresh milk, every morning." So they brought him a goat, the kosher lebekare amita, and they tied it to the legs of his bed. Every morning he would suckle fresh milk directly from the animal's udder. L'yomim nichnesu chaveru levakrei. One day, the Chosid Echad's friends, the other Chachamim, came to visit him. Kibin Shiro Oisa Eis Shura Bakari Amita. They saw the goat tied to the legs of the bed. Chosir Lacharem. They turned around. They said, "We don't want to visit him." But Omru, they said, "Listen, Mizuyan Bevesa Shazeh. There's an armed robber in this person's house because." Again, you're not allowed to raise the Hemadaka in Eretz Yisrael, and the animal is not going to be tied up to the bed all the time. Inevitably, you're going to have to send it out to pasture sometimes, and as we said, you're not allowed to do that because it's likely to damage other people's fields. So, v'onu nechnos and etzlei, how could we go visit such a person? So, Yoshu Bodku, so the Chachamim then sat down to figure out, are there any other Avedis that we should be giving him Musaf for? The only thing they could ever find wrong that this Chosid Echad did was violating this din about raising goats in Eretz Yisrael. The Afu b'shas mi sase amar. Eventually, when he passed away, he says, "Yedea ani she'in bi oven ela voin oiser eis." I know that the only thing I ever did wrong was about having that goat shavarti al divrei chaverai, which with that I violated what my friends said, what the Chachamim said, that I shouldn't be raising goats in Eretz Yisrael. Now, this is in other words in his vidui before he passed away. Now the question is, I mean, if it's a matter of pikuach nefesh, right? So how? So why? What's the problem? So Maharal Shah says it may not have been. It may have been a cholah she'ein bo sakana. It's a painful disease, whatever it is, but it doesn't rise to the level of sakonis nefashis, so he shouldn't have been matter it for himself. Another point is, again, when it comes to things involving dinim mominis, involving concern for other people's property, you have to go the extra mile. So therefore, he should have done that. He should have found some other way to be able to do the matter without violating this din of raising behemadaka and Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, he's saying by his vidui before he passed away that he recognizes he shouldn't have done this after all. He had it tied to his bed for so that every morning he could suckle from it, and then the rest of the time, what's happening with the animals, it's going to have to graze outdoors or something. Yom Mashiach Ogola, Aleph Cheshvan, second day of Rosh Chodesh. Yalkut Shimoni brings like this. The first Beis Hamikdash was finished. They finished the construction of it in Chodesh Cheshvan. And they even had the Chanukah Sabayis then. But it was only opened the following Tishrei, because Shlomo HaMelech wanted that the Chanukah Sabayis should be in Tishrei, because that way it would be together with Sukkot. So, and the Yalkut continues. It was the same thing with the Mishkan that Moshe made. They completed making it in Kislev, and they only set it up in Nisan. So the Medrash says over there that Hashem, so to speak, owed Kislev for that. And now, as Hashem said, I'll pay it back when? In the times of the Chashminoyim, when you have the Nes Chanukah took place in Kislev. So in the same vein, the Yalkut says, Cheshvan, Hashem is going to pay it back, that the Chanukah space in Mikdash HaShlishi will take place during Cheshvan, and there will be Kiflayim L'Toshiyah. It's even a stronger and greater Chanukah Sabayis than any previous one, and that's how Cheshvan will get what it deserved after all. We were just started talking about yesterday about from the Alter Rebbe's Shulchan Aruch about when a person wakes up, he has to say Moda Ani. Now the Friedrich Rebbe said, and it's brought in Sefer HaMenhagim, that when you say Moda Ani, you put one hand against the other and lower your head. So what does that mean? There's a couple of different ways that Lubavitcher Rabbanim take it. Either it means you sit up and you lower your head a little bit and you hold your hands together like this, one against the other, or that you hold them or it doesn't have to be necessarily sitting up. Some people say it's still laying down, and they put their hands on their heart, the left hand and then the right hand over it. You seem to get up suddenly, that's the next thing he says. The point is, with Moda Ani, is that way you remember that Hashem is standing over you and you wake up with Zeruzos. You have also, you're looking in Kuntres and Yonash al Teres Achsidus, the whole thing is that Rebbe explained, not the whole thing, a large part of it, is that Rebbe explains all the deeper ideas about what's Moda Ani all about. So, a person can get up right away, because the Gemara has the expression that a person gets up right away is closer to death than to life, so you should wait a little bit until he'll say this nusach while he's lying down or while he's sitting, and then he gets up.
But the one from the researcher says you should touch the ground with your feet.
Right. So if you're going to sit up, then you should do it without your feet yet touching the ground. Right. So I guess why it is that some people say it laying down and other people sitting up. Maybe it depends how close their bed is to the floor. I don't know. But yeah. Okay.